Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 23rd of June. Thanks to Veronica Rickert for filling in for me yesterday. I have a few days to use up before the 1st of July, so I did. Thanks, Veronica. I do want to make one more announcement before we get rolling with the first hour today. As you know, we've been promoting this Springfield trip, and I won't highlight it anymore because you'll be disappointed if you waited until today to know that the trip is filled. I kind of thought it would be. How can you pass up a wonderful experience like this? We do have a waiting list already, too. So thanks, everybody. Looking forward to meeting you and having a terrific time in October as we celebrate Abraham Lincoln's 200th birthday. Thanks. We filled it up in no time. This first hour of our program today, last week we had guests from Milwaukee's Benedict Center, from the Women's Harm Reduction Center, joining us to talk about programs working with women who have been incarcerated, helping them to gain work skills, self-esteem, and also a safe haven. One program works specifically with women, sometimes quite young, who are working the streets, a hazardous profession at any time, and particularly now with a serial killer on the loose. We had response to that program from various organizations who are working to combat domestic violence, as the subject of domestic violence came up in that earlier program. Many prostitutes have experienced violence in their homes with their boyfriends or husbands or fathers, and it was suggested that we do a show on this issue, and so we are this hour. This afternoon in Madison, the second annual Celebrate Independence Lunch is taking place, hosted by Domestic Abuse Intervention Services, which provides emergency services for domestic abuse survivors and their families, including programs specifically for children who can suffer emotional and psychological trauma from witnessing the abuse of a parent or guardian, trauma that can last for years. Shannon Berry is with us this hour, Executive Director of the Domestic Abuse Intervention Services in Madison, and we'll be welcoming phone calls, as we always do. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and you can use that email service if you'd like. That address is talk@wpr.org. Shannon Berry, thank you very much for being with us this hour. Hello.
Hello, Kathleen. Thank you
Hi,
for
Shannon.
Having me.
Sure, our pleasure. You know, I've been doing talk shows for years and years and done many shows on domestic violence, but it's one of those issues I was saddened to learn that it's still a very large issue, very relevant in today's society. Somehow you think, well, we've talked about this, it ought to be gone by now, but it's on the increase, isn't it?
It is, and unfortunately, here in Dane County, about one-third of all arrests are domestic violence-related. And certainly, Domestic Abuse Intervention Services, we've seen a huge jump in our numbers since the economic crisis in terms of people requesting our services. So in times of struggling government funding and economic recession and how that impacts fundraising, we're unfortunately seeing a huge increase in the demand for our services.
What's the connection between bad economic times and domestic violence?
Well, you know, there's really not much research or there's not a really definitive connection. We just have seen it anecdotally in our services. And so I can't speak, you know, at the national level, but just anecdotally in our services, we're seeing it. And for a lot of families and victims, they're reporting to us that their family is under a lot of financial stress, which is causing more stress within the marriage, and abusers may be lashing out more because of job loss or because of financial stresses and things like that. So even though there's no definitive connection, we're just speculating in terms of the increase that we've seen in our numbers. To give you an example, in one of our programs, in our children's program, if you look at the first quarter of 2008 compared to the first quarter of 2009, we've seen a 53% increase in the number of kids coming to use our services.
Oh, that's
and that's
sad.
Part of the reason that we're so excited about the luncheon today is to really highlight our children's program. And that's what this fundraiser is all about, is about our children's program.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me where it is we learn this kind of behavior? Do you hear that you have a much greater chance of becoming an abuser if you grew up in a family where there was abuse, if you saw abuse between your mom and your dad or, you know, some family member? Is that true? Do we learn this when we are children?
Well, it certainly is a risk factor. Children who grow up in violent homes are more likely to become abusers or victims in their adult relationships. And that's according to a study that was done by the Department of Justice. That doesn't mean that every single child who grows up in a violent home is destined to repeat the violence. It's just an additional risk factor.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really what our children's program is all about, is to help kids, you know, number one, just be kids, and because a lot of times they've had to grow up too soon by witnessing the violence in their families. They've had to take care of younger siblings when one of the parents has been injured. Sometimes they have to take care of the victimized parent. But the other piece of our children's program really focuses on helping kids to think about nonviolent conflict resolution, to think about safety planning when they're feeling unsafe, either in the home or in the community, and to really help them kind of figure out for themselves, you know, what kinds of relationships they want to be in.
I was interested in reading some of the literature from your organization that children tend to, not all children do, but children tend to act out in different ways. Some may indeed try to become a perfect child to make everything better everywhere.
Right, that's exactly true. There's a lot of research that shows that children who witness domestic violence have a lot of the same outcomes as children who are direct victims of child abuse. So you might have a child who acts out, you know, who has poor peer relations, who becomes delinquent, who uses alcohol and drugs, things like that. However, you might also have the flip side, where you have a child who tries to take on becoming the perfect child, because, you know, especially for little kids, you know, their world is really, they believe that the kind of the world revolves around them, and that's what they're supposed to believe when they're kids. I mean, that's developmentally appropriate for little kids. But if you're a small child and you're witnessing violence in your home, it's really natural for kids to start blaming themselves and thinking, well, if I can just be a better, you know, Susie or a better Bobby, then maybe this parent won't abuse the other one.
Mm-hmm.
So they really start internalizing the belief system that somehow they're to blame, and if they can just be good enough, maybe the violence in their family will stop.
Right. I was interested in a piece that was in Madison.com, and it's public knowledge here, but if you could tell the story, because it's probably pertinent to other lives as well, of Mr. Phelps, Ron Phelps,
yes,
who you had hoped could be at the luncheon today, but he's off doing good work,
right,
in the world, who grew up in Milwaukee and saw violence in his family, and mm-hmm, he tried to become that perfect child.
He
right?
did, and Ron is a perfect example of a man who's an ally in this movement. He did witness domestic violence when he was growing up, and did try to become this perfect child, and it really impacted him dramatically, where it has impacted his adult relationships, where he's very conscious of being a healthy and supportive and nurturing partner. But he definitely fit into that hero role as a child from a violent home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Ron's just wonderful. He was on our board for many years. He's been an avid spokesperson talking about the effects of domestic violence on children.
And it's affected him in terms of, he says he is not married, he has a great dog, and there's nothing like a great dog in this life, I'm the first one
right,
to say that, but probably has had some problems with relationships because of what he witnessed when he was growing up, a reluctance to get into a long-term relationship.
Sure. I mean, if the primary relationships that you've experienced as a child has been unhealthy, I think it can really cause one to take pause, to wonder if one wants to get involved in a relationship as an adult. And I think that, you know, again, Ron is very, very conscientious, and I think really tries, you know, he's been really thoughtful about the kinds of relationships he wants to get into. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. Sometimes, you know, more of us should maybe be thoughtful about the kinds of relationships we get into.
Right. I brought this up, I think, when we were talking with the women from the Benedict Center, that I know that you're also looking at teen problems and relationship, dating violence, et cetera, mm-hmm, which starts so early. I don't want to make too much of this, except that it's one of those things you hear and it kind of knocks you out. You know, I'm familiar with high school students because I have a son who's in high school. We were talking recently about this Chris Brown case, which now has been in the news because I can't believe he got so light, you know, well, he's going to work this off instead of going to prison for this horrible beating.
Mm-hmm.
And my son was saying to me, you know, a lot of people in school still think that he's a great musician, that there's not, you know, he's still kind of cool, even though he did this thing. And I'm thinking, wow, what world am I living in to believe that most young people would think this is a horrendous thing that happened? We have to take hold of this issue. And yet the response has been among a lot of teenagers, oh, it's okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a really good point. I mean, I think that there's so much violence in our culture and in our media. And a lot of, as a former school social worker working with adolescents, I can say that a lot of the role models that adolescents have are tend to use violence. And whether or not that's, in television shows where violence is glorified, or in video games, or in music, and I'm not going to scapegoat rap music because there's a lot of other music that has violent lyrics that's not rap.
Sure.
But, I think that kids are just sort of inundated with this, and that kids start seeing violence as an acceptable way to interact with not only their friends, but also with potential dating partners.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when you have a case that was as public as this one, where the sentence was so light, we're not reinforcing to our communities that these are serious crimes and that we need to hold batterers accountable for their actions.
We sure do. These figures also are so alarming. 1 in 4 teenagers will experience violence in dating relationships between the ages of 12 and 21. 1 in 4?
Yes. Isn't that alarming?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, and we think about... so often, I think, especially for teens, they're really trying to assert their independence from their families. So they may not even reach out to their parents or to their schools to talk about what they're experiencing. A lot of times they're seeking help from their peers versus from adults. And that's, a very normal developmental thing to do, that teens are trying to express their individuality. They're trying to, assert their independence. But unfortunately, it sets kids up because then, their peers don't necessarily know how to interact. And a lot of times, teens might use violence to try to solve violence. So if you have a victim who tells their friends about the violence, the friends may try to retaliate against the perpetrator, which doesn't serve to keep anybody safe. And so I think it's really important for parents and for educators to have frank conversations with teens about what it means to be in a healthy and safe relationship. What kinds of expectations do each of us have about our relationships? What are the things that we will and will not accept? And how do you reach out for assistance and safety when bad things do happen?
Right.
So I think it's really important for us to continue to have those dialogues with young people.
Where are we missing the mark here, Shannon? Love, I think that somebody wrote a publication, Love Shouldn't Hurt, and mm-hmm. Love really shouldn't hurt in the way that we're talking about now. Where are we missing? We're missing something big here.
Well, I think a lot of it goes back. I mean, I think that over the years we've done a much better job in terms of the intervention side of things. For example, the coordinated community response to domestic violence and sexual assaults that most, counties around the state of Wisconsin have, where we're bringing together law enforcement, judicial, victim advocates, abuser treatment, and all of those folks at the table. So I think we're doing pretty well there in terms of the intervention side. I think where we're behind is on the prevention side and the primary prevention side. And, primary prevention isn't just, addressing kids who are quote-unquote at risk for violence in their adult relationships, because everybody, frankly, is at risk of being an abuser or a victim in their adult relationships. So it's really kind of going upstream and doing primary prevention to help kids sort of navigate the many mixed messages that they get about gender roles and about violence, and helping them to kind of deconstruct those and come up with their own ideas about what it means to be in a safe and healthy relationship. So that's where I think a lot of energy needs to focus. And we've seen a movement in that direction. The Centers for Disease Control has put some additional funding towards primary prevention. And Dane County is, we actually have a primary prevention program here in Dane County that brings together a lot of different partners, including our agency, but also the schools, different community centers, to really kind of help adolescents look at a lot of the messages of violence in their community and decide for themselves, what they believe. We don't preach. We just kind of help kids explore what they're hearing, what they're consuming as media consumers.
Mm-hmm. And what about law enforcement? Would most counties throughout Wisconsin have a standard procedure of what law enforcement should do when they encounter domestic violence?
Well, there is a mandatory arrest law in the state of Wisconsin. So when there are cases of domestic violence that meet certain criteria, law enforcement are mandated to arrest physical aggressor, the primary physical. It's not primary physical aggressor anymore. The language has changed. I can't think of it off the top of my head. But there is a mandatory arrest law, and so all law enforcement need to abide by that. It's a state law. And part of the reason for that law was to really take the pressure off of victims of having to make the decision of whether or not they wanted to press charges against abusers. And it really, again, is a community message that says that violence is unacceptable. In terms of training for law enforcement, there are a number of, I believe law enforcement is mandated to have training on domestic violence, but I don't know that there's actual, criteria of what that training needs to look like. So different law enforcement agencies may do training a little bit differently. Here in Dane County, we're very fortunate that we have a sheriff who is extremely supportive to domestic violence. He was a domestic violence detective himself for many years, and so he really understands the complexities of these issues. And we're also very fortunate to have a police chief in Madison who really understands these issues as well.
Mm-hmm. And what about the issue of finding safe haven and, in some cases, having to just leave a relationship? Is it still hard, particularly for women, and they are most frequently the victims of domestic violence, is it still difficult because you sort of get into this cycle and you're worried about your safety even if you leave? Is it hard for women to find a safe haven, A, and B, to be able to leave?
I think it's extremely difficult for victims of domestic violence to leave, and there's a number of different reasons. The first reason, I think, is fear. We know from national statistics from the Department of Justice that victims of domestic violence are 6 times more likely to be murdered by their abusers when they're attempting to separate from their relationship than at any other time. And that has certainly been true here in Dane County with the domestic violence homicides we've seen this year. In those instances, the victims had been separated or were trying to separate from the abuser. So there's that, certainly. I think another piece that a lot of as somebody who's worked with victims for many years, another piece that a lot of people overlook is that a lot of victims love their abusers. Their abusers didn't start out as abusers. I mean, like every other relationship, these relationships start out with a honeymoon phase where, the abuser can be very charming, where the victim really falls in love with the abuser. And it isn't until later in the relationship that violence may erupt. And so a lot of victims sort of hold on to that hope that maybe the abuser will go back to being the way that they were at the beginning of the relationship. So if the victim can just, do whatever it takes, that maybe the abuser will go back to that person they first fell in love with. And then another piece is, children. A lot of victims, in Wisconsin, there's a presumption of joint custody and physical placement when there are children involved and a couple has separated. Except in cases of domestic violence. But the onus is on the victim of domestic violence to prove that there was domestic violence. So a lot of times we're seeing domestic violence victims who are having to share custody of their children with battering parents, and that can also put them at risk in terms of safety. And there is a lot of fear about what happens to the kids when they go off with the battering parent for their custody or visitation, and the victimized parent feels like, if they were there, then the children may or may not be targeted. So a lot of times victims will stay with their abusers in order to stay safe for either themselves or for their children, which may seem very counterintuitive to a lot of us who aren't in abusive relationships.
If you are involved in abusing your significant other, are you more likely, and if so, how much more likely to also be involved in abusing your children?
Well, according to the American Psychological Association Presidential Task Force on Violence in the Family, fathers who batter the mothers of their children are twice as likely to seek sole custody of their kids, and they're 3 times as likely to be in arrears of child support. They are also, and I'm There are also 53% of men who abuse their female partners also abuse their children. And that's according to a book that was published a few years ago.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in just one moment. Our guest this hour is Shannon Berry, Executive Director of the Domestic Abuse Intervention Services. They are based in Madison, and they're having a very big luncheon today looking at the issue, particularly of safety of children when there are abusive situations. It's the second annual Celebrate Independence Lunch taking place today, which provides this organization we're talking about this hour, provides emergency services for domestic abuse survivors and their families, and programs that are specifically for children who can suffer, understandably, emotional and psychological trauma that can go on for years. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we talk with a young journalist who's the author of a really compelling book, To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. Our guest was only 27 years old, traveled to Pakistan to try to understand the country, and was a fearless, fearless reporter. He lived with his wife in Islamabad. He learned Urdu, and as he says, in a country where the people you know could save your life or be your death warrant, traveled extensively, befriending and engaging with all sides, including terrorists, and eventually was forced to leave the country. He did return. It's a really amazing story. He'll be with us the second hour of our program. 800-486-8655 is the number this hour for Shannon Berry, Executive Director of Domestic Abuse Intervention Services. One line is open if you'd like to get it right now. You're welcome to it. And we start with Rick from Prentice. Hello, Rick.
Hello?
Go ahead, please.
Oh, all right. Well, I'd just like to say from the onset that I don't believe in domestic abuse. I don't believe in any kind of abuse. And I'm not a lawyer, but I have a really big, I think it's a legal, if not a cultural, disagreement with your guest, who personally I regard as quite a charming person. But I really think that we've diverged so much from the traditional way that this would have been handled, you know, years ago. A man beats up a woman, or a woman beats up a man. You know, that'd be criminal battery, aggravated battery. It'd be some kind of a crime. It'd be investigated by the police and then by the district attorney, and the perpetrator, male or female, would be appropriately charged. Then there'd be a jury trial, and the rights of the defendant or the charged person would be protected, you know, the Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Sixth, and 14th Amendment, due process would all be protected. But in this present system, where we rely, especially in Milwaukee County, particularly on these domestic abuse restraining orders, they have a system where the people who apply for these orders go to the seventh floor of the courthouse, and they go through training sessions with civilian volunteers that have no connection with the government, and they're trained on what answers will get a restraining order and which answers won't. Essentially, their testimony is extremely heavily coached by these very enthusiastic civilian volunteers. So you got a situation where you can get a 2-year restraining order against a person merely by the allegation that that person called a young woman the B word, you know, whether he's in a relationship with her or not. But then the standard of proof in these cases is preponderance of the evidence, which means you know, you can just say really any old thing and get a restraining order. There's
all right. Let's get a response to this, Shannon.
Well, it's interesting what the caller is bringing up. I can't speak to Milwaukee County. In Dane County, you know, it's not easy to get a restraining order. I think it's important to point out that a lot of the things that he's citing have to do with criminal court. Restraining order is a civil court process, so it doesn't require a charging decision or anything like that. And there are a number of different kinds of restraining orders. There are domestic violence restraining orders, harassment restraining orders, child abuse and neglect restraining orders. So I'm not exactly sure what the caller, which kind of restraining order the caller is referring to. But, you know, here in Dane County, you know, typically if one goes in to file for a temporary restraining order, which is usually 2 to 4 weeks before the case is heard before a judge or a family court commissioner, those are oftentimes granted because the expectation is that then it will go before a judge or a family court commissioner to decide whether or not the restraining order will be granted for 2 to 4 years, depending on what kind of restraining order it is.
So would you say... Maybe there's a middle ground here. Would you say that there are then too few restraining orders, or he's suggesting there are too many for a variety of reasons? Some he thinks are pretty minor. Would you say that there aren't enough, perhaps?
Well, I don't know that I'm saying that. I think, you know, it depends on what county you're in. It depends on which family court commissioner you get, which judge you get. I think in Dane County they do a really great job of investigating and hearing all sides when they grant or don't grant restraining orders. So I guess I'm not suggesting that. I just think that there's this this myth out there that it's really easy to get a restraining order. And at the end of the day, the purpose of restraining orders is really to diffuse a situation so that it doesn't get to a criminal point.
Mm-hmm.
So that if somebody is feeling unsafe and has told, you know, a partner or someone else to stop harassing or to stop victimizing them, that this is really a tool for them to use and in hopes that the violence won't escalate to, you know, a more dangerous crime. And oftentimes with restraining orders, a lot of people would rather seek out a restraining order than report to law enforcement and go the criminal justice route. So, and in fact, there may have been crimes that have been committed against the victim that they have not reported to law enforcement because they don't want to get involved in the criminal justice system, and they'll go the restraining order route instead, thereby potentially keeping the abuser out of jail if it had gone to a criminal situation. So it's sort of interesting. I guess if I were an abuser, I'd rather have someone take out a restraining order against me than go to jail. But it sounds like, you know, for most abusers, either doesn't sound good to them because in either situation, they're being held accountable for their actions. And really, I think it's up to us as a community to really respect the needs of victims of domestic violence. You know, maybe they don't want to call law enforcement because they feel that that might put them in more danger, and they'd rather go the route of a restraining order. For other victims, they may want to call law enforcement because if they feel that that will keep them safer. So it's just one of many, many tools. It's not, and most like most things, you know, like mandatory arrest too, nothing is perfect. It's part of, you know, our legal system is that we kind of do the best we can, and our legislators do the best they can to sort of give us as many tools as possible as citizens to stay safe.
Let's go to Ruth from Madison next. Hi, Ruth.
Hello.
Hi.
21 years ago, I was homeless from escaping an abusive relationship, after I landed, then I got a bunch of friends, 5 women, 5 trucks, a bunch of empty boxes, and we would help people move out. Like 15 minutes after he left for work, we'd swoop in there and get her out of there. But there's a lot of preparation and a lot of legwork, and that's what I wanted to talk about with strategies for leaving. Because, you know, the previous caller, you know, you don't have to be battered every day. You can, all he has to do is hit you once, and you're afraid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and you don't always report the one time, you know. Who would? You know, oh, maybe it'll never happen again. And then the next thing you know, you're being threatened. And if you're afraid, and if it escalates, mine escalated real quickly to where he had a gun.
Ooh.
But it wasn't in an illegal kind of way. It was just very threatening to me. And he hadn't done anything illegal. So under the advice of the local battered women's shelter, I got out of there, but I called the police and I opened up a file on myself because I didn't need to prove anything about myself. I could just say, if anything happens to me, I'm afraid of this person. Here's why I'm afraid of this person. Write it down, put it in a report, you know, and then because he knew I had done that, that restrained him also from doing anything to me because he was going to be the first person they looked at if anything happened to me. But the thing is, if you try to get a place to stay, you know, the rental situations these days is the landlord will come in 3 months ahead of time, and you either have to renew your lease 3 months early, or they want to be showing your place, and so your partner will know that you're not renewing your lease for 3 months. And so you really don't have a lot of choice with this. You know, there just has to be a better way. You know, the thing is that, you know, and if you go out somewhere else and you rent a place in anticipation, in 3 months I'm going to move into this place, well, then you've got the paperwork. And if you come home and you've got a purse full of paperwork and he goes through your purse that night, it's not illegal to go through your purse, right? You know, and then he finds your new rental agreement. So you have to have someone trusted that you can mail it to so you don't bring your paperwork home. You know, and just say, if you get a letter from me, don't open it, just keep it for me, you know, or you can read it, but don't tell anyone that I've got, you know, what I'm doing. But it is very, very, very hard to leave, and compounding it with children, you know, you almost have to have a strategy of where you can go homeless with
yes.
family or friends for a few months while you don't renew your lease.
Mm-hmm. Those are such great points. Thank you so much for bringing that up. You know, I think that there is this sort of belief system and this kind of, you know, this mythology out there in our community that, you know, it's really easy for domestic violence victims to just leave their relationships. And the caller brings up so many great points about the numerous things that domestic violence victims have to do in order to leave safely, in order to plan for their safety. It's also interesting that she brought up the point about homelessness. You know, according to the U.S. Conference of Mayors from 2003, 44% of the surveyed cities stated that domestic violence was the number one cause of homelessness in their cities.
Oh, my goodness.
And so it really brings up a great point about the fact that we need to have services in place in order to give people the time and space that they need to plan for their long-term safety. I'm sad to say that here in Dane County, we only have a 25-bed shelter, and that's for all of Dane County. And as I said earlier, one-third of arrests in Dane County are domestic violence-related. So we are often full, and we do have some amount of money and some flexibility at times to put people in hotels when we're full for a very short period of time. But our limit at our shelter is 30 days, and that's primarily because the resource doesn't meet the demand, and we have to, you know, make sure that the resource is available to as many people as possible. But in 30 days to try to pick up everything and start your life over, you know, I mean, if any of us have ever moved, we know how challenging that can be just to move, and that's not even starting your life over. So I'm glad that the call, I really appreciate those points, because I think that a lot of what Domestic Abuse Intervention Services does is we help people decide if, number one, if they want to leave their relationships, because some people don't want to leave their relationships. They just want to be safe in their relationships. And we help them safety plan for that. But number two, if they do want to leave, to help them create a plan so that they can do so safely. And it may take many, many months in order to do that, or in some cases, years. So I appreciate that caller's comments.
So when they do decide they want to leave, and if your facilities are small, and I would imagine that's the case if there are even facilities all over Wisconsin,
right?
Where do people go?
Well, we would offer our other services, like we have community-based advocacy where we can go out and meet with somebody face-to-face at a safe partnership site where we have security and things like that. We offer legal advocacy services. We offer our support group. Our children's program goes along with our support group as well. So we would offer other services. We would also try to network with other shelter providers if that was safe. But a lot of times, you know, if we're full and if we've used up our money for hotel vouchers, we have sometimes helped people relocate. Sometimes they're on a waiting list and they just call in every day until they can come in. Or, you know, other sister shelters around the state may take them as well. But that's also really difficult to even relocate to another part of the state. You know, because a lot of times things like food stamps and things like that are tied to specific communities, so you can't relocate and access those types of services immediately.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was intrigued when you said some don't want to leave and we try to keep them safe in relationships. How realistic is that? If you decide to stay, can you live without fear?
You know, it's such an individual question. You know, it's really up to each individual. I will say that at DAYS, we never have a plan for somebody. We meet people where they are in terms of what they want to do with their safety, and we try to help them by providing them as many options as possible. Again, there's so many reasons that people may stay in abusive relationships. You know, as I mentioned before, fear is certainly one of them. The children is another. Financially, you know, maybe some victims haven't been allowed to work by their abusers. They've never had access to resources. They don't have a credit history. Maybe they've never been on a lease. And it just feels too overwhelming for them to leave. So they might stay for financial reasons. And then, you know, of course, we can't overlook love. I mean, I think that a lot of people, again, kind of hold on to that hope that the abuser will change and that the relationship will go back to being like it was at the beginning of the relationship. You know, and for abusers who go through abuser treatment, that may or may not be the case. You know, we work closely with abuser treatment providers here in Madison. So we try to empower victims of domestic violence because for so often, for them, the power has been stripped from them. Mm-hmm. So whatever they decide to do, we will support them in terms of, I mean, we would never say to somebody, okay, well, you have to leave your abuser in order to use our services. We don't operate that way. We meet each person where they are in their journey.
Shannon Berry, our guest this hour, Executive Director of Domestic Abuse Intervention Services. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email, you can use that if you'd like. Nobody has, but you could. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program, the author of To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. We go back to phone calls now. Lorraine from Elkhart Falls. Hi, Lorraine.
Hi there.
Hi.
I just wanted to say the gentleman that called previously stating that he didn't believe in domestic violence, and that people are coaching, you know, women or men, according to him, on how to get a restraining order is kind of reckless. For the women like me that are survivors, there is such of a thing as domestic violence. That's a reckless thing to say. The media takes no responsibility in reporting a lot of this stuff. A lot of women, it goes unreported because, as Shannon said, women don't report domestic violence. They stay in the relationship because family court issues, children, so on and so forth. So it seems like the circle of abuse never stops with men.
Shannon.
I think that the caller makes some good points. You know, unfortunately, I don't think that our communities still talk about domestic violence as much as we should. You know, when I mentioned earlier, some of the greatest growth that we've had over the last 30 years has really been with the legal system, with the, you know, criminal court system, with the with law enforcement and judicial systems. However, I think one of the things that we've really slipped back on is really getting the word out that domestic violence does exist in our communities. It's still such a hidden issue. And, you know, the reality is that it affects a lot of people in our communities. It affects one in four women in her lifetime. So that means every single one of us has a mother or a sister or a neighbor or a friend. You know, people may not know that person is a survivor, but the likelihood is that we all know somebody. And so I think that, you know, in order to continue to have you know, forward movement in talking about domestic violence as a community. It can't just be, you know, victim advocates talking about domestic violence. It can't just be law enforcement talking about domestic violence. I think we all have a responsibility to engage in dialogue about these issues and to really bring them to the forefront of our communities to say that that domestic violence is not acceptable.
And it's all communities. It's rich and poor and all different ethnic groups, gay and lesbian and everybody. It's everybody.
Right. It knows no boundaries, you know. And I think that there are a lot of people who may not talk about domestic violence because they think, well, I'm not one of, you know, I'm not like those kinds of people. I'm not going to be a victim or I'm not, you know. And the reality is it can affect any one of us. And I think that when we ignore that fact, when we you know, say that domestic violence only happens in certain communities, we're really doing a disservice to victims because, as the caller said, you know, they don't feel safe coming out and saying, you know, I'm a victim or I'm a survivor of domestic violence for fear of being ridiculed or even getting those questions about, well, why don't victims just leave? I think as a community, we need to switch that question from why don't victims leave to why do abusers do this? That's the better question. And we need to stop placing blame on the victims and start holding abusers accountable in all areas, including how we dialogue about this issue.
Right. Tell me about the work that you do with children at your center and how children need to be helped.
Sure. You know, as I mentioned before, children from violent homes or children who witness domestic violence have a lot of the same outcomes as children who are direct victims of child abuse and neglect. So they're at higher risk for depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, poor peer relations, truancy, poor school performance. So, you know, and again, as I mentioned, a lot of times children feel responsible for the abuse that's happening in their homes between their parents. And so we really work hard. And it's, you know, a lot of times people say, oh, well, you just have play groups or whatever. We do. A lot of what we do is recreation and giving kids the space to just be kids, to come down to our kids' space, to interact with trained volunteers and staff who, you know, who have a lot of training. Like they go through at least 40 hours of training so that they know how to interact with kids and to just give them a space to feel safe and to just play and be kids. So often, you know, children from violent homes, especially older children, as we talked about earlier, Ron Phelps is a great example of that. They take responsibility for the younger siblings. They might kind of take on a parental role of younger siblings. And so this kind of gives us a chance to say, you know what, we'll take care of your younger siblings. You guys just go play. Because a lot of what children need in order to process their feelings about the violence that they've experienced is play and art and things like that. That being said, in addition to the play groups and recreation groups we have, we also do some group activities around specific themes, like how, you know, a safety plan and how do I feel safe in my family or in my community? You know, who are safe people I can talk to? A lot of children from violent homes have been told by both the perpetrator and the victim that the police are not your friend. Mm-hmm. That if the police come, that one of the parents is going to be taken away, and so that you shouldn't trust the police. So we kind of help, you know, we might go through different safe people with them and talk about their feelings about law enforcement. We also do a lot of activities around feelings because a lot of kids from violent homes have sort of learned that it's not safe to express your feelings, either because they've seen the victimized parent express their feelings and then be hurt, or the child has been told, you know, you have to stay silent about this. This is our family's business. So they start getting so numbed out that they can't even identify their own feelings. Like, what does it mean to be angry? What does it mean to be sad? What does it mean to be confused? So we do a lot of activities around feelings. And then we do a lot of activities about non-conflict resolution. So, you know, for children from violent homes may often, like if one child sees another child with a toy, they might, rather than ask to play with the toy, they might go up and slap the other child because that's what they've experienced at home. And so we really talk about, you know, how do you use your words instead of using violence to get what you want. So those kinds of things. But obviously at a developmental level that a child can understand.
Right. And can you as a child feel safe and develop a full life even though you have all of that going on at home? Or does that render it almost impossible to have any kind of happy childhood?
No, I don't think it renders it impossible. I mean, again, it's certainly a risk factor for, you know, all of the things that I talked about. But, you know, children are also, they have a lot of resiliency factors. And it's children with more resiliency factors tend to do better. So, for example, having other safe adults to talk to, having other adults in their lives who listen to them, who tell them that they're important, who praise them, having things like sports and art programs at school and things like that where they can kind of work out, because a lot of how children process is very kinesthetic, and so places that they can kind of work out their feelings. And so I think that there's a lot of different resiliency factors that can really help you know, help cocoon kids and protect them from this, from the violence. However, again, it's still a risk factor. And at the end of the day, children, for children, their most important people in their lives are their parents. And so, you know, if you can help parents be safe, then you're helping kids be safe.
Thanks for the call, Lorraine. Jan from Green Bay. Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead, Jan.
I guess in listening to your conversation this morning, one of the things that I've heard be said is the fact that, you know, we keep hoping that this abuser is going to change. Mm-hmm. And I was in an abusive relationship for 11 years, left it 10 years ago. And the hardest thing to give up is hope.
Right.
And I think when you, when something inside of you accepts that this is never going to change, it's the beginning of letting go and moving on.
Mm-hmm. That is such a great point, Jan. And I think, you know, so often victims of domestic violence, too, have internalized blame about the violence that they're experiencing. And, you know, what, you're right. Once you let go of that feeling that it's somehow your fault, then you can recognize that the abuser is the one who's making the choice to use violence. And I think that that's a very freeing thing for many victims of domestic violence. I really appreciate you bringing up that point.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Lucy from Oshkosh. Hi, Lucy.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm 24 years old, and when I was 20, 21, 22, I was in an abusive relationship. I used to dance, and I got caught up in a man that said he was going to get me out of it. And every day he would tell me that I owe him, mm-hmm. that he rescued me. And I would get hit and kicked. I would get a gun to my face, everything. And I'd go back. I would go back. And my mom would come and rescue me at 4 o'clock in the morning. And I'd go back. And finally, it took him going to jail to get me not to go back. But I would write him letters every day, mm-hmm. still, and it was just so hard to let him go. Because mm-hmm. he made me feel like he rescued me. I owe him something. Mm-hmm. And he would tell me that almost all the time, that I owe him. And when he went to jail and everything and he got out, he blamed me that he wasn't that bad, that I had a lot to do with it, too. And it just, I don't understand, and I can't, it sometimes gets hard to say that it's not my fault when I was just always getting blamed that it was my fault.
Lucy, first of all, thank you so much for sharing that. I think that you're sharing a perspective that a lot of domestic violence victims and feelings that a lot of domestic violence victims have. So I appreciate you being so honest about that. I know that that's really difficult. You know, there's a wonderful book by Dr. Judith Herman called Trauma and Recovery. And in the book, she basically shows how the psychology of domestic violence batterers and victims really mirrors hostage situations and war. And I think that it's probably one of the best books I've ever read in order to understand sort of how abusers really are systematic in how they create, cause their victims to start believing that somehow they're to blame. So in this situation, you know, he's telling you he rescued you from what he's presuming is even a worse situation for you. So making you feel like he's your white knight. I mean, that's a very systematic way of manipulating somebody.
Yeah, he always made me feel like he needed me and I needed him, and that, you know, everything that he was doing was for a reason, because I either was at the store too long or I was talking to somebody that I shouldn't have been talking to. Mm-hmm. It got to a point where we would go out to a bar, and any guy that would stare at me, he would go up to them and tell them to buy him a shot for looking at me. Or he'd get in a fight with them for looking at me too long. Mm-hmm. And then I'd go home. If we'd go home, and I'd get yelled at for wearing my shirt too low. Mm-hmm. And it was really hard. But I got out of it. But this is the thing that I hate. I got out of it, but I got out of it with an addiction. Oh. Because I got addicted to marijuana. Mm-hmm. because that was my only release from everything that was going on in my head, because right. every day he would call me 20 times a day from jail,
wow.
trying to get a hold of me, and I couldn't get away, but finally I did. And I try to tell girls that I see that are in relationships that, you know, you can see right away mm-hmm. once you've been in it that that's not like, oh, man, that's a sign right there.
Right.
I've seen that before. I've heard those words before. And I try to give them advice, but it's the same thing. That's never going to happen to me.
Right. Yeah, and so you bring up two really good points. I mean, the first one...
We only have about 15 seconds,
okay.
I'm sorry.
The first one is about your addiction, and a lot of victims of domestic violence will often use substances to cope and to numb out. The second is, you know, with other young women or with other victims of domestic violence, it's really difficult to understand unless you've been through it, and it's really just, I think, letting them know that you're there if they ever need you is a really important thing. So thank you so much for that call.
Yes,
I appreciate
thank
it.
You. Thank you. Hope you're feeling healthy now. Shannon, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you. Our guest this hour, Shannon Berry, Executive Director of the Domestic Abuse Intervention Services, which is based in Madison. And they're having a big lunch today, the second annual Celebrate Independence lunch. They're hosting that. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to John Treader for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios, and thanks for all of your calls, everybody. News is coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with more conversation on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.